Will the clerk please call the second case?
The court will now call City of Grapevine versus Ludmilla Lee Brown. May I please report Mr. Joe Greenhill to argue for the appellate and Mr. J. Patrick Sutton to argue for the appellate.
May begin.
Chief Justice Sutter, your honors, and may it please the court. Joe Greenhill on behalf of the City of Grapevine, the appellant in this case, and I'm joined at council table by Matthew Boyle, who is the city attorney for the City of Grapevine. This case arises out of City of Grapevine's reaffirmation of its longtime ban of short-term rentals and the plaintiff's attempts to invalidate that ban.
Wasn't the City of Grapevine collecting taxes for a significant period of time on these short-term rentals? And didn't it also assure, I mean, I know that there's no estoppel when you're talking about the government, but do you disagree that these homeowners reasonably relied on what they were told by the city and what was going on to believe that, in fact, their STRs were okay?
Your Honor, as to the taxes, yes, the city was collecting taxes. Those are required by state law, and that's true regardless of whether or not the activity in question is a zoning violation. And in regards to the insurances, the only, as you noted, there's no estoppel, nor can any kind of assurances bind the city in any way because the city can only speak through its council. The only relevance the assurances might have would be to the reasonable investment-backed expectation under the Sheffield case in the, as relates to the takings claim.
And the city is giving these homeowners 45 days, conditional grace period, to do something else with their properties. Do you think that that's a reasonable amount of time?
I do believe that's a reasonable time under the facts of this case because the property owners would be able to, there's no prohibition against them leasing long term. And I don't believe there's any evidence in the record to suggest that they could not do that within 45 days. But that goes mostly to the takings analysis, but I want to point to one thing that one argument that we've made in our brief that takes care of the takings analysis without having to delve into the reasonableness of their expectations, and that's that the plaintiffs have failed to exhaust their administrative remedies by failing to pursue an administrative procedure before filing this lawsuit, and that's dispositive of this entire case. And it also doesn't require the court to delve in to whose interpretation of the 1982 zoning ordinance is correct here. Now, in short, we believe that because the plaintiffs did not challenge two city officials' determinations that the zoning ordinance prohibits short-term rentals before the city's Board of Adjustment within 15 days of those determinations, they have failed to exhaust their administrative remedies and the trial court lacks jurisdiction.
Do you think it was Boyle's announcement or the determination letter that triggered the deadline?
Both, Your Honor. Either one is what we contend with determination.
How could a mere announcement trigger that deadline? Explain that to me.
If you look at a case we cited in our brief, Lazaritas, it's 367 Southwest 3rd, 788. In that case, the Chapter 211 was triggered by a city building inspector's announcement at a city council hearing that he had made a determination, and then that's what triggered it. There's nothing in Section 2, and we're talking about Section 211.009 and Section 68 of the zoning ordinance that requires some sort of official announcement on behalf of the city official to trigger the administrative process.
But those two things, Mr. Boyle's announcement at the September 4th meeting and then the letter that went out, not under any particular city official's name, several days later. I mean, if we're talking about triggering a specific 15-day period, I mean, which one of those dates was a homeowner supposed to count from?
I would argue, Your Honor, that either one of them is what they should count from. They were all present at the September 4th City Council hearing at which Mr. Boyle announced that he and his staff had reviewed the zoning ordinance.
But if the city's taking the position that Mr. Boyle's announcement was it, and somebody waited, okay, so you've got September 4th plus 15, September 19th, but then somebody's looking at the letter a few days later and requests administrative review on September 22nd, couldn't the city have said, oh, Boyle's announcement was it, you're too late?
No, well, it would depend, Your Honor, on whether or not the person was present at the city council meeting and received notice.
What if they were present?
If they were present, then that would trigger the 15-day deadline, Your Honor. And if they were not present, if they received a letter then that's what would trigger the 15-day deadline. If you look at the Lazaridis case, it talks about the notice to the plaintiff, and when they were aware of the facts, that'll let them know that they need to file their administrative procedure. I'd like to point the court, though, to this court's opinion in City of Grapevine versus CBS Outdoor, 2013 Westlaw 5302713. It's cited in our brief, and it's particularly instructive on this case because it involves the exact same zoning ordinance, it involves the exact same administrative procedure, and it involves the two same administrative officials from the city. So in that case, CBS operated a billboard. They asked the city if they could alter it slightly. The city sent a letter from Mr. Boyle at the behest of Mr. Williams, the building inspector, informing CBS that they could not alter or remove the billboard because it wasn't in compliance with the zoning ordinance. Several months later, CBS filed suit complaining about that determination, and Justice Meyer held that claim, the trial court lacked jurisdiction over that claim because they had failed to exhaust their administrative remedies under Section 68G and Chapter 211 of the Local Government Code. So as we've talked about in this case, we think both Mr. Williams and Mr. Boyle's determinations triggered Chapter 211 and Section 68 in the 15-day period, and it is undisputed that the plaintiffs did not file a grievance with the Board of Adjustment within that window.
So you disagree that there has to be some element of enforcement?
Yes, Your Honor. I disagree with that. If you look at the CBS case, there was no prosecution or enforcement. It was a letter informing them what they could and couldn't do. And that triggered the chapter Section 68 and Chapter 211. The plaintiffs have offered some excuses as to why they believe they didn't have to do this. We've gotten into some of them. There's one in particular I'd like to just touch on for a minute, and that's the idea that because there's asserting constitutional claims, they don't have to go through the administrative procedure. And the rationale there is, well, the administrative body here, the Board of Adjustment, doesn't have the authority to rule on constitutional claims. And that's true. But in the, as this court pointed out in Watson versus City of Southlake recently, 2019 Westlaw 4509047, and that's cited in our response to their plaintiff supplemental authority. In that case, was Justice Birdwell was the author, joined by Chief Sutterth and Justice Gabriel. And the court said it is immaterial whether an agency has the authority to resolve the constitutional claim at issue. The issue is whether the administrative body can render relief that moots the plaintiff's claims. Another case that I'd like to point you to is Garcia versus City of Willis, 2019 Westlaw 1967140. That's a Supreme Court case that this court relied on in Watson. And so that's exactly what we have here. Had the plaintiffs gone to the Board of Adjustment, complained about the city officials' determinations that the 1982 zoning ordinance prohibits short-term rentals, and they had gotten a favorable ruling that it does not, then there is no ban on short-term rentals, and there are no claims. There's no takings claim, there's no retroactivity claim, there's no due process claim. There is no ban, so there are no claims.
So would we have any ability to look at the 82 ordinance and decide yes or no, it didn't ban STRs, and what if we decided that the 1982 ordinance did not ban STRs, what does that do to the plaintiff's claims?
So, Your Honor, let me that question, I'll just back up real quick. That question, the interpretation, is not material to whether or not the plaintiffs exhausted their administrative remedies. In CBS, the case, the plaintiffs made the exact same argument about a misinterpretation of the zoning ordinance, and Justice Meyer held, well, that's not material to the exhaustion point. So we're not going to address it in this case. So that's what we have here. But then if you get beyond that and want to interpret the 1982 zoning ordinance, it would have the same effect if you interpreted it that it did not ban them. Then there is no ban, and the city's got to go back to the drawing board and figure out what it wants to do as far as either amending the zoning ordinance, because the new ordinance didn't do anything except for reaffirm the old ordinance's prohibition.
That's the city's position, that it reaffirmed.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's
correct. I'll touch on that here in a minute. But I would just like to point out that, again, that the exhaustion of the remedies point takes care of this entire case, and we believe it's a very strong point about the fact that the plaintiffs undisputedly failed to appeal the decision to the Board of Adjustment.
Okay. Going beyond that question, which I agree with you. If you're right about that, that would make things a lot easier. How do you discuss the Zatari case, that recent case out of Austin, and the difference between the, I mean, I understand that when you're talking about real property, typically the verbiage is vested rights, but mm-hmm. Chief Justice Rose was talking about settled rights in that case, and so I'd be interested in your take on that decision.
Sure, Your Honor. The Zatari case, I just want to first mention that it, to the extent it has any relevance at all, and I don't believe it does for the reasons I'll get into in a minute, it is only relevant to whether or not the plaintiffs have pleaded a valid retroactivity claim. It doesn't have any relevance to their takings claim, to their preemption claim, to their due process claim. And so in that case, it's a little different because the city of Austin had admitted that the law was retroactive, that it had been permitting short-term rentals, actually passed out permits to them, and then all of a sudden it banned them. And Chief Justice Rose said, in that narrow situation where it had been historical, I think the use was historically approved use, they had a settled expectation, a settled right for a retroactivity claim.
And you don't think that the Grapevine homeowners had any sort of historical expectation that what they were doing was allowed?
No, Your Honor, again, because our position is that they've always been prohibited in the city. And in addition to that, I think if you look at Justice Kelly's dissent in that case, it points out that the right at issue isn't necessarily retroactive. Instead, it's actually prohibiting prospective use. It's saying, okay, we're going to ban them on this day. So it's not necessarily a retroactive law, and I think that is more on point. And particularly if you put that into context with the University Park versus Benner's case that we cited in our brief, that property owners don't have a right to use their property in any specific type of manner. I think that answers the question under Zatari. But again, Zatari also does not address the question before this court about the exhaustion point.
No. I understand it's apples and oranges. I was just curious to hear your thoughts on Zatari.
Sure. And that, with regard to the interpretation of the ordinance, the city's interpretation of the ordinance, it is our contention that what the plaintiffs have done is seek an advisory opinion, which, of course, the trial court lacks jurisdiction to consider because it is our previous ordinance, not the 2018 ordinance, that actually bans short-term rentals. And so I'm going to go through our interpretation just for a minute, so because it does get a little bit complicated, I'll admit, but I'm going to try to boil it down to a basic concept. And as this court knows, it interprets city ordinances exactly like it would a statute, and in particular, one of those rules is undefined terms are given their common ordinary meaning. So the city zoning ordinance prohibits any use not specifically listed in the ordinance. So the ordinance is not silent. Under Baird versus City of Melissa, there's an identical provision that says if it's not listed, then it's prohibited. So is it our position that short-term rentals are not a permitted use in the city? And here's where we get that from. The plaintiff's houses are in R75 and R5 districts, which permit single-family detached dwellings, which is what the plaintiffs believe their use of short-term rentals are. So if you look at the definition of that term, it's a enclosed building that has accommodations for it and is occupied by one family. And then a family is defined as a group of people living together, and this is the key phrase, as a single housekeeping unit.
For what duration?
And that's what I want to get at, Your Honor. That phrase is not defined in the ordinance, but if you look to, and we cited you a number of cases from outside of Texas, I'd urge you to read Slice of Life. It's a very recent Supreme Court case from Pennsylvania. That phrase historically and commonly means to be a single housekeeping unit, you have to be there with some degree of permanency. And so the Slice of Life case out of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court considered the exact issue before this court, where the zoning ordinances from the city had a very, very, very similar definition. The Supreme Court in that case said, well, short-term rentals, because they're transient in nature, which is less than 30 days, they don't fit. And I was only able to find one Texas case that sort of touched on that concept of a single household unit, and I'll point you to it. It's Collins versus City of El Campo, 684 Southwest 2nd, 756, and it's a 1984 Corpus case, refused NRE. It does not necessarily say that that term requires some degree of permanence. The issue in that case was whether four unrelated people could qualify as a family, and the court held that it could, but in its discussion of that phrase, it noted that the people were living there permanently. And so I believe it supports our position. If the court has no further questions for me at this time.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm going to focus today solely on what I think is the single most weighty issue that the city has raised, and indeed I think it's going to be a weighty issue in these cases all over the state and all over the country. What is the vested right, and is that a narrow vested right, as discussed in the Tiki Island Village case, or is it something more fundamental? Now, the question before the court today is actually not to answer that question, because we're only talking about jurisdiction. But it is the elephant in the room. And even if you decline to give us, in your opinion, an answer as to what you think that vested right is, or if it exists, you will have to reckon with opinions that do, including the Nuzatari case. And I think I agree that it would be a waste of everyone's time if you found that the pleadings, quote, conclusively negate the existence of a vested right, because then that issue probably needs to be addressed either in a subsequent appeal in this case or by another court. I think the most useful thing that I can offer the panel today is the benefit of 10 years of litigating these cases regarding both deed restrictions like TAR and city ordinances. And so what I'd like to talk about is this enforcement question, Justice Carr, that you raised. How these cases get prosecuted by cities, I think, will give the court a sense of why there is a vested right. So when a city bans short-term rentals, as Austin did, what happens is we see neighbors calling in complaints to a hotline or to the code department and saying, there are people going into my neighbor's house that I have not seen before or whom I do not know personally. At that point, code enforcement shows up. Maybe they surveil, maybe they walk up to the door. Sometimes they look in windows and take photos. Someone comes out, and here goes the quiz. Who are you? Do you live here? Where are you from? How long are you staying here? May we see a copy of your lease? Oh, it's not a lease. Is there a financial arrangement here? These are all questions that relate directly to what the ordinances do, for sure. And if you believe the ordinance is valid, then an investigation like this has to occur. I think what I would suggest to the court is we have now trampled important constitutional rights of citizens, irrespective of whether there had been an ordinance before. You have ordinary people going to and from a house day by day. On Monday, a family gets out of a car, goes into the house, is there until the next day doing what families ordinarily do. And in fact, you'll see a discussion of this in both the Tarr case in the Supreme Court last year as concerns deed restrictions. And then the Nuzatari case, which relies on TAR, talks about the same thing. Are people doing what they ordinarily do in a house? And if so, why is code enforcement knocking at the door, asking them about their movements, their intentions, their citizenship? Why is it asking them anything? If all they have done is walked into a house and behaved as people ordinarily do, why should they be investigated for any kind of violation of anything? So, let's talk about what happens when we find out that there was either a home swap or that the person confirms that they're only staying there for 3 days. Well, sometimes they have a lease for longer than 30 days, and it turns out that they happen to only have needed it for 3 days, and then they left town. Sometimes they do have a short-term lease. They were only there for 3 days, and the owner gets a citation. And so now we have a panoply of remedies that the city will employ. Now, it's in the record what would happen. Well, it's in the record what Grapevine intended to do here, but we don't have a final answer how it would play out. But I think it's important for the panel to understand how it would play out. The letter that the city sent to the existing short-term rental ordinances does not purport to enforce anything. That's the difference in the case that was discussed earlier, where the person with the outdoor sign gets an enforcement letter from a city official. That's not what happened here. What the city says is we intend to start enforcing this, and we have asked a city department to develop a plan for how to enforce. All of this is going to be coming in the future. So we don't yet know what the city is going to do to our citizens who have people coming and going from their houses. We only know that there will be some sort of mechanism. What is that mechanism? Well, there's Chapter 211, which appears in the briefs, and this is the Board of Adjustment process. We have cited case law to you that explains that the Board of Adjustment process under Chapter 211, where you get a determination or decision by a city official, then goes to a panel of 7 to 9 people for resolution, and that's your administrative due process. I would also point out that under Chapter 11, imprisonment is a possible penalty for engaging in short-term rentals if that's the route the city pursues. In other cities around the state, what has happened is the city adopts by another ordinance the procedures of Local Government Code Chapter 54. And this can be citations for municipal court, or it can be an alternative, what's called quasi-administrative procedure, where you have an administrative hearing officer, and under the relevant statutes, you then have an appeal to the municipal court. And the reason that the cities employ this procedure is because it only involves fines, not imprisonment. So Chapter 211 and Chapter 54 have some overlap, and as cases we've cited show, they can both, either or both can be used, but one has prison and the other has merely fines. So we'll have an enforcement mechanism where a citizen goes in and says, let's take the appeal route. I wish to avoid this $5,000 fine you just imposed by proving to you that I did not engage in a short-term rental. Well, those are the cases that become moot if they are decided at the administrative level. If an administrative, I'm sorry, not moot, that where an administrative procedure has not been exhausted and so jurisdiction may not arise. And so it is common that in a case where someone has been given a fine, like the recent case in this court where someone ran a red light and had a fine imposed, that citizen said, I don't want to go through the administrative procedure. And what the court said is, well, the administrative procedure could get rid of the fine, in which case there's really nothing for us to decide. You don't have a taking. Indeed, in Austin, we argue the cases when we can to the through the administrative procedure, but in Zatari, that didn't happen. And in a trailing case called Anding, actually, in the trailing case, Anding, it did happen, but the constitutional claims had nothing to do with the fact that the Andings had, in fact, been fined and gone through the appeal process below.
Let me ask you a question about Zatari. I don't know if it's really a semantic difference or something more fundamental, but obviously Chief Justice Rose is talking in that case about settled rights versus vested rights, and I know that in your supplemental authorities discussion you seem to sort of suggest that those were the same things. To me, it seems that vested rights sound a little more hierarchically important than settled rights. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on what, if any, difference there are in those two terms.
I think the only difference is which cause of action, which constitutional theory is being asserted. So I think the way the retroactivity cases got developed at the federal and state level, the term that got employed was settled. And it has to do with the fact that governments pass laws all the time that will affect somehow something that people have been doing before. And what became important was not whether they had specific money interests in something, but whether it is, in a loose sense, settled that people have this kind of right. In the other doctrines, substantive due process, equal protections, takings, the language that has been employed is vested. It seems to be more like a money or property issue as opposed to the broader concept of a settled right. Why is that important here? Because the settled right that we're talking about in short-term rental cases goes beyond economics and property rights. It is a, and this is referenced by Justice Rose, but it's not developed because the city didn't raise the kind of issues that are raised here. And it gets back to what it means to have, for private property owners to make decisions about who will use and occupy their properties. That certainly has an economic component, but it also has a deeper private component. Land is important historically to us. Richard Mueller, in this case, the record would disclose from the summary judgment record, he had allowed hurricane relief victims to rent his property. Pam Holt, one of the plaintiffs, has set up one of her properties for families of cancer patients, and that's a common fact pattern in Houston where there's a big cancer center. And so owners have lots of motivations in how they set up the uses of their property. So long as those are residential, those are always permissible. Where you cross the line is where the uses become commercial, which also is an issue that rears its head in this case. So the answer to your question is settled versus vested is important, and it does inform what I think this court has to help us understand in this case, if not necessarily decide. What do Tiki Island and Zatari mean when they talk about settled or vested rights, and is it narrow or is it something broader and more fundamental? You don't actually have to decide that today, because I think it's clear that under the Tiki Island Village analysis, we have a narrow vested right in what we were doing under the prior ordinances. So that's the Tiki Island analysis. There's some stray language in there which is similar to Justice Rose's, but we always felt like, let's take the narrow win if we can get it on jurisdiction. It was when the Zatari arose that we start to see a pattern, we start to see courts more interested in talking about more fundamental rights. I will briefly address, since I mentioned Tiki Island and the narrow vested right, a point that the city made about whether these prior ordinances barred short-term rentals. And their argument would go all the way back to 1982 because it says what is not expressly permitted is allowed. That was an argument I addressed in Tar as well, and I would commend to the court's attention the Tar opinion's discussion of what it means when a document is silent and whether it is clear or unambiguous whether a right is allowed. And what Tar said is that when a document is silent as to a right, it clearly and unambiguously allows that right. Now again, that's a deed restriction case, not an ordinance. But in this case, I will remind the court that leasing is not expressly allowed in the Grapevine ordinances. So the city's position would obviously be that leasing has not been allowed since 1982, and that is an absurd position. That is not true. What the court needs to recognize, and I hope my discussion has set the stage for this, is that an owner's decision about the length of someone's occupancy on their land is all part of the question about the leasing right. And the leasing right can encompass long or short terms, intermittent terms. It can encompass someone's decision to lease the property for a day and not use it for more, lease the property for a year but not use it for more than a day. People in the airline industry will have apartments that they may use 2 days a month. The city of Austin was enforcing this domain under short-term rental ordinance, that if they had a 30-day lease, that still did not comply because they did not physically occupy the property for the entire 30 days. Deeply personal, private interests are at stake and are intimately bound up with economic rights in these cases. It is not a successful argument to say that short-term rentals were something unique and specific that needed to be called out in the city's ordinances prior to now. People have been doing it for a long time. I would assert to the court that it is a settled and vested right, irrespective of whether it was allowed under an ordinance, but you don't need to go that far. You can say that the Grapevine ordinances allowed leasing. They did not differentiate any kind of duration as a salient term until 2001, when all they did is say, for bed and breakfasts, we're not going to regulate short-term leases.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Just very briefly, Your Honors, a couple of points. One thing I did not hear him dispute in his presentation is that the administrative procedure would have provided them the relief that they sought had they gotten a ruling in their favor. And I think that's important because that's the primary argument to get around exhaustion. Now, with regard to the CBS case and enforcement, the CBS case did not involve an enforcement letter. Actually, CBS sent a request to the city to alter the sign because it needed to do so because of some state condemnation proceedings, and the city simply responded that that they could not alter or remove it. I don't believe it was an enforcement letter. In any event, the letter from Mr. Williams does in fact say, if you do not come into compliance with our zoning ordinance within 45-day grace period, then we're going to start citing people for that. Briefly, just to touch on TAR. As you noted, TAR was a deed restriction case. It has nothing to do with municipal ordinances. It also didn't have the phrase single housekeeping unit, which is what I believe is the critical phrase. In TAR, the court held that short-term leasing is not necessarily a commercial use of the property. It can be residential if the people are there to sleep, eat, and things like that you'd normally do. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. But in this case, we do have an unambiguous, if you look at the slice of life case, an unambiguous limitation on the length of time that people can lease their homes. And one thing I do want to clear up is that the city's position is not that leasing has never been allowed. It's that leasing has never been allowed for less than 30 days. And that 30-day cutoff comes from the Texas tax code. And I have the site in here somewhere if I can find it. But it defines permanent resident as someone who leases for more than 30 days.
How does that play with the bed and breakfast homestay regulation?
So the bed and breakfast, we raised that as a way to illustrate the point that the drafters of the zoning ordinance contemplated some sort of permanence. So bed and breakfast popped up, sort of like short-term rentals popped up, and the city took a look at it and thought, okay, we're going to allow these things in very specific areas, like could have done here with short-term rentals. And when they did that, they used a term called single-family transient dwellings or something to that effect. And what that does is it illustrates that the drafters of the original ordinance understood that single-family dwelling had required some degree of permanence, and it's different from a transient dwelling.
But the single-family dwelling transient rental was excluded from
the bed and
definition of a bed and breakfast?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But it is our position that it illustrates. It's why include the term if they didn't appreciate the difference between a single-family dwelling and single-family dwelling transient rental. Couple of final points. The due process claim that they've raised, I think, is precluded under the CBS case as well. It held that the trial court lacked jurisdiction over that claim. And then they didn't touch on the preemption claim, but I just want to point out that They haven't identified no statute that shows with clear and explicit intent the preemption issue, and as the court is aware, in the City of Fort Worth versus Riley case, in that case, the occupations code was the statute that was claimed to have preemptive effect. It actually taxed these eight-liner machines, and the court held that it didn't have preemptive effect. So if there's, with that, Your Honors, I'd like to ask the court respectfully to reverse the trial court's denial of the city's amended plea to the jurisdiction in its entirety, at the very least, in part. And if there are no questions, I'll yield my time to the court.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. Your case has been submitted, and you are free to leave. Thank you.